Today is Thursday. It's January 16th, 2020. It's 12:45 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. Here we go again with another edition of The Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast recorded at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. Remember to email me if you have questions or comments for The Rascals, John Williams at WGNRadio.com.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn, the vicious, horrible columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Heather Sharone, the Managing Editor and City Hall Reporter for the Daily Line.
Normally we correct or ask for a clarification of Eric's introduction, but I think we can just leave that one.
Yeah, I'm not that interested.
I don't think it needs any further explanation. By the way, do you guys think we've talked about this off? I didn't tell you I'd bring it up here, but since I mentioned that I want our listeners to email us if they have a question or a comment, maybe they would also comment to us if they want us to do a public performance of The Mincing Rascals at some pub.
Like a birthday party thing?
Theater.
Yeah, I already do birthday parties.
I can do balloon animals.
Where should we bring it, and would you come? If we brought this gaggle of folks somewhere and did a slightly longer version with audience interaction, your questions and comments and praise, do you think that'd be fun?
Sure.
Yeah. Try and be more. Let's try that again.
Hey, well, Steve, wait. I can't believe you truly are just springing that on all of us as we're doing the
Eric
podcast.
Springs it on me all the time. Yeah. Eric's very anxious to get out there. And I am too, but I'm worried that no one will show, that we'll be at a Malnati's in the suburbs and no one will be there. And
we did a live show at the Old Town School.
We sold it out, but that was during a podcast fest where people were primed to go.
We were the main draw. Come on.
So,
we should do it on the street, the true origins of the podcast.
Like the Bug House podcast.
Bug House Square. Well, and by the way, one last thing before we do get into the meat of today's episode, That is, Eric, we said last week on our podcast that you would explain the origin of the name Mincing Rascals.
Well, yeah, it was what happened was that the United States filed charges against some Chinese hackers over in China for doing some espionage. And, of course, we couldn't get to them. And so when the news broke about this, the official Chinese press came out and said that because the United States also engages in international espionage, they said the United States is a mincing rascal when it comes to...
So we're mincing our words. We're rascally about this whole thing.
I just thought, Mincing Rascals, that's great. And since I couldn't form a punk band, I decided to give the name to a podcast.
Well, that's good. So for those of you wondering how we came up with Mincing Rascals, I knew a version of that story. I didn't know it exactly. Let's begin mincing.
I like how you didn't know for a long time.
I'm still not sure I do. And I'm not clear on the details on this, guys, so everybody help me with this. I was writing my notes about this. And then Austin started to help me, and as he did, I got more confused. In 2012, Pat Quinn was governor, right?
Correct.
Okay, that's all I know. a now-retired lobbyist named Mike McLean, who's a close friend of Mike Madigan, right, the speaker, sent an email to aides of Governor Quinn.
Correct.
And in that email, McLean asked for leniency on behalf of a prison worker who was going to be disciplined. He might lose his job. Still true?
Correct.
McLean's email reminded Quinn's people that this connected worker kept his mouth shut about the rape in Champaign. We don't know what rape we're talking about here, do we?
Not yet. We do not.
And keeping his mouth shut about the rape in Champaign doesn't mean that there was a rape that took place that they didn't tell anybody about, but rather, don't we believe it was a rape for which someone was caught, prosecuted, went to jail, but later got a job that would be embarrassing to the administration were that exposed?
I'm not sure. It's not clear. I'm not sure that's... I think my understanding, one report on this is that this person was released, the person who committed the rape was released
early. If you remember, Governor Quinn did that, a budget thing. He did a lot of releases, right?
Yep, okay.
And this, I'm not sure that this particular early release was part of Quinn's initiative or just part of the way things go, but that he then raped a teenage girl, correct? Is that
after he got out?
And he was caught and prosecuted, and I guess the idea is that this prison worker did not raise alarms. He was in a position where he could have gone to the media, he could have made a big stink about the early release program. This could have been embarrassing to Quinn, could have harmed his election campaign against Brady, right, at the time?
Correct.
So, see, this guy got released from prison early, and then he went out and committed another crime. Willie Horton.
Yeah.
And so the idea was that if this was released, disclosed, it'd look really bad for Quinn because he was letting out violent people. So the accusation or what they're saying in this email is this guy kept that quiet. He could have blown the whistle, but he didn't.
And there's some allegation that it occurred at a state facility, which makes it even worse, essentially, that this teenage girl, you know, was essentially a ward of the state.
But the original idea that this guy was aware of a rape that had not been prosecuted or reported and had kept quiet about that, we don't know. I mean, that still could be the case. We don't actually know. We're all kind of talking through our hats here, but it's a podcast. So that part of that allegation is not quite as pungent as it might have been.
I think it's plenty pungent.
Well, sure, but I mean,
really? I mean, because you think that this guy had an affirmative obligation to go to the media with something that was in the public record?
I mean, he had an obligation to go to the authorities if he had information about a rape, especially if it were a rape of a minor.
But it was known.
I don't think it was about what he should have done. I think it's about what he could have done. He could have come out and embarrassed the governor. But he didn't. I don't think there's anything about him being obligated to report a crime that was obviously reported and prosecuted.
See, I disagree. I think if you're like a human being, and if you have knowledge of a crime, you are obligated to go to the police and say, "Hey, I have information on this."
Well, we're talking about not going to the media, though. It's not clear to me that this guy had any information that the police needed.
Would help
the person had already been arrested.
That's what the email makes. And when we report the clip,
right,
that
we don't know
that he kept quiet about the rape, it makes it sound like he kept quiet about the rape to police. That's not the case. What
we don't think
the
it's
inference
the
case.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Okay,
don't
but
know.
Let me finish this thought. But one way to interpret this is that he was keeping quiet about going to the media about this. Is that how you read it?
Yeah. One inference could be that he did not connect the dots for media that this violent formerly violent offender got out, recommitted a crime. But then the second part of it, and that the rape in Champaign quote is what is making everyone call for Illinois State Police involvement, special prosecutors, all of this stuff. It's also the reason that Madigan gave for not wanting to convene lawmakers for a panel to investigate this because, you know, this is a rape. It's a very sensitive thing. We want to be sensitive to the victims. The other half of the email has ghost payrolling in it. It's clear embezzlement. So that does warrant some kind of response.
Oh, that's true. And of course, you're right. If he knew about ghost payrolling, that probably wasn't prosecuted. It wasn't known. So he was keeping quiet about something he should have gone to authorities about, which is but it's not quite as dramatic, I guess.
So let me ask you all this. So the email went to aides to then Governor Quinn, right?
Correct.
So perhaps those aides, high-ranking aides, or the governor is implicated in one way or another. Jones, maybe, because he said Jones ghosts or
whoever
something
Jones
like that.
Is.
But the story, every time we mention Mike McLean, we call him a close confidant of Mike Madigan. Now, so why is the tie to Madigan relevant to this story?
Well, the implication is that this would have been damaging to Madigan because the only correct me if I'm wrong here, Austin, but the only reason McLean would be involved would be to protect the speaker. And that somehow that this whole thing would be damaging potentially to Quinn and to other Democrats. And if we might just take a step back and laud the admirable work of our colleagues over at WBEZ, who went through 10 years of emails sent by McLean to governor's chiefs of staff to unearth this, I want to call it a nugget. This has been buried for years.
So the reason we care about Madigan's involvement is because McLean, he's not just like the speaker's friend. He is the eyes and the ears of the political and policy side. He's the closest Madigan has to a bag man for every deal. We know also from WBEZ, he had a magic list of lobbyists, quote unquote, that you could pay off to curry favor with the speaker. At the same time, he had a magic Excel seat of Democratic Party of Illinois donors. And what I don't want to get lost in the story is that this behavior, which I think, regardless of what the ultimate very specific details end up being, is not the result of some personality trait or quirk inherent to Mike McLean. It is a consequence of the power wielded by the Speaker, and that power comes from policy choices. It's been consolidated through the House rules. It's been consolidated by the fact that he gets to serve as Democratic Party chairman and Speaker. It gets consolidated by the fact that he draws the map. And very importantly, in the case of Forrest Ashby, it's consolidated by the reckless accumulation of debt to pay very high benefits and perks to workers like Ashby. So I just got a FOIA response back from the state employees retirement system on Ashby, and the story will be up later today. But he retired from the state employee pensions, state employment in 2018. He is 54 years old. He contributed $120,000 to his retirement over his career. He will receive $2.7 million in pension benefits.
Wow.
That buys a lot of silence, and it buys a lot of loyalty as we see a window washer auspiciously coming down the window.
Yeah, no kidding, even as we speak. That's fascinating, and thank you for doing that. IllinoisPolicyInstitute.com to find the story.
IllinoisPolicy.org.
Pardon me.
So $2.7 million, is that's an estimated lifetime.
Yeah, if he lives what Social Security says he
lives. How much is that per year? I can't do the math.
So he starts out very low, but you get those sweet 3% raises. So he starts out about $60,000, but it goes up to six figures later in life, and it really adds up.
Here's the email, by the way, the last paragraph of the email from Madigan, or from Michael McLean that we're talking about. It says, but Gary, for God's sake, do not let this disciplinary meeting get out of hand. This man is a good compliance person, as I told you. The AG's office and the sheriffs love working with him. He has kept his mouth shut on Jones's ghost workers, the rape in Champagne, and other items. He is loyal to the administration. Thanks. Best, Mike. Best, Mike.
Peace sign emoji.
Thanks. Yeah. Best, Mike. One or the other, seriously. Thanks or best.
But you don't do both.
You don't do both.
I
Thank
do
you
both
for that, Eric.
Sometimes.
Thanks really? Best, I don't even do best because it to me seems...
There's your listener poll for tomorrow.
I like best.
Eric, though, I think Eric should get some credit. He did call last week. He called this story as something that could be, we thought could snowball potentially. And Greg Hines did call for him to step down as Speaker.
Who? And, Mike Madigan.
And
yeah.
The Daily Herald has called for him to step down.
And the Daily Herald did.
And
he
won't. The Tribune has already done that many
Willie?
Times.
So.
I was going to say, don't they just run that every so often?
But Pritzker can't find anything.
The Pritzker response to me, which he spoke with Chicago Tonight with Amanda Vinicky, and she asked, so what would it take for you to call for him to step down as Speaker? And he essentially said, a raid or an indictment. And that is so embarrassing that you can't have the political leadership of the state.
The balls.
The political leadership of the state has to wait for federal agents to bust down someone's door to understand what's right and what's wrong.
Well, on the other hand, Tom Cullerton, still in the state Senate, indicted. So that's actually a higher standard than other Illinois Democrats. So I'll give the governor, just a little bit.
Wait
there.
A minute. Well, what are we asking the governor to do?
Well, I think Austin is asking the governor to call for Madigan to resign.
But that's not binding. He's just saying, hey, you ought to step down. Still have your job.
Except I think, the optics are not good, but if he wants to get anything done, if Madigan decides, well, screw you, JB, if you're going to call for my resignation, we'll see what happens to all your
really?
Oh,
that's
in
the price?
In the meantime, we can have Mike McLean and whatever lobbyists have filled his place send lots of emails and have backdoor meetings with people saying how they shouldn't discipline state workers because they knew this behavior
because they were good
to
the administration. And by the way, the other thing that we haven't even touched on, and I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on things that we don't know every detail on here, but he kept his mouth shut on the Jones ghost workers. What's a ghost worker, guys?
Someone who is not, who does
about
not
one
work.
About one out of two state workers.
That's good. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, just someone who has a no-show job, essentially.
Do we know what ghost workers we're talking about?
We don't. The most prominent Jones in Illinois politics would be the Jones, Emil Jones, and his son. Emil Jones, the elder, was president of the Senate before Cullerton.
So who are the ghost workers?
Who knows? But you know, there are people who have
loyal to him somehow.
You know, somehow. But perhaps not Emil Jones. I'm just saying that.
But Jones would have been president of the Senate at the time of the email.
Not at the time of the email. No, it was. I think Culverton took over in 2009.
But still, a person of influence. I mean, it's not wild. Listen, we're being honest here. We're not sure, but it would not be wildly inappropriate to wonder out loud if it's not Emil Jones.
This could
be
Ebenezer Jones. We don't know for sure.
And importantly, I believe his wife had a very senior position in state government. Government as well. It could have been her.
He's loyal to the administration is the last sentence in this. And so this McLean guy writes this email to whom?
To Governor Quinn's chief of staff and legislative liaison.
Just as a sort of interference thing, just to sort of help out Mike Madigan, who isn't mentioned in this. He's not the governor, but he's just saying since if this goes public, it looks bad not just for the governor and all the principals involved, but it could boomerang on Madigan. So he's just running a little proactive interference here.
And I mean, it could have just been, you know, McLean was very close friends with Forrest Ashby. The other reason why Madigan is implicated in this, and this point's very important. If McLean has dirt on someone in politics, so does Madigan. Madigan would have known both of those things as well if Mike McLean is putting them
even
in
the
email.
Madigan denies that he knew anything about a rape in Champaign.
Heather, who's the worst then in this? I mean, who looks the worst, right? Who has the most to lose? Madigan maybe because he's Speaker, but I mean, besides that, what are other implications here are bad?
So I will tip my proverbial hat to Mayor Lightfoot, who when we asked her about this a couple of days ago said that she was thinking of the woman at the center of this, that somehow if there was a rape, which of course we don't know, that this woman has essentially become at the center of Illinois politics and is potentially being re-traumatized. She's potentially reliving all of this and that she may feel threatened. She may feel like she's in jeopardy. I think she's probably getting the worst of it right now, along with John Sullivan, Governor Pritzker's agriculture director, who had to step down because he was copied on that email, which he says he never read.
Which I am not, it doesn't strike me as implausible that you would see an email. I mean, how many of us get emails that are CC'd to other people and you start reading it and you go like, okay, and you don't finish it because it's not
another
to you.
Another ghost worker rape story? You don't read through
on
that?
Well, it's at the bottom. It was at the bottom.
His explanation was that Mike McLean had been sending dozens of these emails advocating for Ashby, and he was tired of it, and that he knew what McLean was saying.
Wasn't he also undergoing cancer treatment? Wasn't that part of his excuse?
Sullivan?
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe so.
Excuse or reasoning. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, though. Pritzker is certainly harder on his ag secretary than his speaker.
It felt a little bit like a sacrificial lamb to me. I mean, I take the guy at his word that he didn't read an email that was not, it was copied to him. As someone who gets a lot of email, everyone gets a lot of email. If you see something get CC'd to a bunch of people, you start reading and go like, this does not concern me. And you delete it. I don't know.
We're going to leave this topic, but where does it go next? Austin, what are you thinking? What happens next?
I'm going to start a punk band called Email Jones.
Nice.
Where does it go next? I mean, this email story specifically is going, the way things are going right now, it's going to go the same way that every scandal surrounding Mike Madigan goes, which is that you triage, you cut out the bad actors, the Tim Mapeses, the Shaw DeCremers, the Kevin Quinns, now the Mike McLeans, and everybody wipes their hands and say, hey, we did a great job fixing Illinois corruption, and they get to make really tiny tweaks around the edges, around lobbyist disclosure or something of that nature, and go into the progressive tax vote saying, hey, look, our state government is great. I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that some people have some courage and stand up for reforms that would distribute power effectively instead of concentrating in one person.
I think that the story is going to come out, though, about what exactly these references are to. You know, that someone is going to do, they're going to call some hearings in some chamber somewhere. Someone's going to figure out what this rape allegation is, what this ghost payrolling allegation is, and we're going to start pulling on some threads. Now, whether this ever gets to Madigan, I don't know, but it also seems plausible to me that at some point Madigan's going to say, you know, all this stuff really isn't worth it anymore. He's how old? He's like,
How much fun are you having?
His 35th anniversary as Speaker of the Illinois House was on Monday.
Well, wasn't McLean asked about this, and didn't he just kind of laugh at the notion that he would come clean on all of the details?
Can we also talk about why Mike McLean, at the center of this firestorm, decided, you know what, I'm going to go to lunch at Chicago Cut where everybody and their mother is having lunch, and that's how WBEZ got a phone call, and they sent two reporters, some of the best in the Illinois business, and a photographer. And not only did he answer their questions, he stood there and let them take his picture, which is so intriguing.
Not a great picture either, I might add. But is that the chuckling incident that I'm referring to?
Yes.
Doesn't all that put together make you think that he? That McLean himself set this up, that he wanted to be interviewed, that he wants to be photo, like, I got nothing to hide or to tell, and just sort of sending a signal.
Well, he was very clear that the feds had reached out to him and asked him to testify against the speaker. He told that to WBNZ, and one of those great Chicago journalism, you know, punch-ups was that, you know, just an hour or so later, the Tribune had a source saying that McLean had been interviewed by the feds and asked to give evidence on the speaker. So, I don't think it was, you know, just happenstance. He wasn't just jonesing for a good steak, is all I'm saying.
Do you think that when he left the restaurant, they put his food in a foam container that he didn't eat, and was
Look
he
at
given
that segue.
Plastic forks,
radio,
knives,
radio professional,
spoons, and if he'd requested a plastic straw?
It was a classy joint, so I don't know if they would offer those types
true.
Of items.
Yeah.
It'll not be an option for him in a year if this ordinance gets passed in Chicago. What do you guys think of that we're going to be a plastic-free, foam-free city like that? Bertrand, go.
I'm all for it, I suppose.
I am, too. Yeah. By the way, I think
weren't really asking me. You just wanted to...
just trying to keep the conversation lively, Steve. I think that this is all
okay,
a problem,
Heather?
Too, of the... industry.
There was almost a literal spit take, I just need to say.
I wrote this down. I think it's really clever if you just let me read it. It says here, this is a problem of the industry's creation, and now we all need to do something about it. They need to find more environmentally friendly stuff, and we need to pay for it. I hate the amount of garbage, and we have a clean city. But it's just amazing to me when I go to Portillo's how much crap they put in my bag that they know, and I know I don't need. So I'm like, all right, fine. Now we're going to have to pay for... You're not going to, you know, the substitutes will be more expensive. Probably not that much more biodegradable, because a lot of biodegradable stuff doesn't biodegrade.
Really? Yeah.
And you're going to end up having to pay more for it, I guess. But I'm okay with that.
I'm not convinced that it can make it through the city council. This is a big change, and it is an indication of how different Chicago politics is right now than it was just a couple years ago. Ed Burke would have been first in line on something like this. Of course, you know, he wanted to ban straws. He's nowhere on this. And it was proposed by a number of aldermen, but most prominently Alderman Scott Wagsback, who's the chairman of the Finance Committee, who is ostensibly one of the mayor's closest allies. But the mayor said she didn't know anything about it yesterday and that she hadn't taken a look at it.
Seriously?
Yeah. And so that's unusual, because if it had been the Rahm Emanuel era, it wouldn't have been introduced unless the mayor backed it. That's not how things are operating anymore. The other thing is that it sets up another conflict with sort of the all-powerful Illinois Restaurant Association, which has complained incessantly that the city is putting all sorts of regulations and requirements on them, minimum wage, sick leave, work. They've got to do a different scheduling way, and there is property taxes, there is no doubt that they are going to complain that they just can't bear this additional cost. So it's going to be a big fight.
Shout out to the Illinois Restaurant Association, though, for backing what I thought was a very good ordinance, which would lengthen the window of time that food trucks are allowed to serve, which is something we've been working on
for many years,
and is a huge deal for a lot of food truck owners who have had to start up hot oil, get all their stuff together, start serving, and then get out of that parking space. And it's led to injuries for workers and obviously not making as much money as you could. So shout out to them for that.
Now, we've all seen these stories about tortoises with straws in their noses and so on. I am skeptical about the idea that plastic straws are a huge problem, given the kind of packaging that you see all the time in grocery stores and restaurants and so on. It seems sort of symbolic to me. The foam shell container things, McDonald's got rid of them for their burgers like 20 years ago, right?
Right.
It does seem like they are overused. Like, you get them for things that don't need to be kept warm, that you're just taking home, that the old doggy bag or little plastic bag is fine for that. It does seem like the restaurant industry brought this on itself by the kind of waste. You talk about going to Portillo's and getting like all kinds of stuff that's thrown into the bag. Like,
yeah.
Like they are profligate about that. And so then when this comes back to bite them, it makes it easier for an ordinance like this to pass. I'd like to see how it works in other places because I understand that it is
in Europe, effect. Canada, for
Didn't
sure.
Didn't you have a guest on one time who said the straw threat was overrated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you want to elaborate?
Well,
I mean, we all got up in arms about straws, and this guy, this expert, said it's really not. There really aren't straws. Aren't really the threat here.
Well, it was. Well, only relative to I think the total mass of plastic that's out there. I mean, nobody's advocating for plastic straws either, except for the convenience they present to us.
I understand, but we're banning straws and not banning other things when it's really. Well, straws are taking the fall, and it sucks.
Would you say they're a straw man for the thing?
Well, the other thing, of course, is that paper straws,
are
the metal
miserable.
Straws, have you tried those?
Oh. I have not tried a metal straw, but the paper straws are suboptimal, I have to say.
The other aspect of this is that straws and this sort of container are really valued by people who are disabled and who have other challenges. So that is also an issue, and I know that this ordinance was crafted
It includes exceptions.
With exceptions and with where you can request these type things as opposed to it just being shoved in your bag when you leave. But that's also an issue as well.
I think I live in the suburbs and I think it's time for the state to start charging for grocery bags. I've watched the city go through it. It's kind of a pain when I'm here. But I'm prompted by you guys talking about everything that's in a Portillo's bag.
Yeah.
You know, I can go buy three items at a grocery store and get four bags. And, you know, it's just crazy.
And the upcharge is not much. It's 7 cents.
Seven cents.
Right. Also, you know, we're talking about other cities that do the plastic bans. And there, I think San Francisco is like the most notable one that has the most broad restrictions. No state has a statewide plastic bag.
It's not a bad idea.
And Pritzker actually floated that initially as part of his budget. And I interviewed some folks. There was a great guy I interviewed in the Quad Cities. He was an Asian grocer owner. And he said, you know what? I'm already getting squeezed so much on this cross-border commerce on this. This bag matters. And it matters to my shoppers. And it's going to have – and there's competition that I have that's going to be that's going to take away my business.
Well, I don't know what the solution is, but I don't need my dozen eggs slipped into a plastic bag to be put into a paper bag.
But you tell them that, right?
Well, you can already bring a reusable bag like we do.
I know. They're in my car.
You don't need...
Mine are too. Yeah. I know.
The state legislature does not need to step in to say, hey, don't put my eggs in a bag.
But they do, because otherwise we don't.
You come with me next time?
I mean, Chicago tried it both ways, right? They tried it initially so that they would make the bags thicker. So that they would be that people would feel like they could reuse them, and that failed massively.
Yeah.
And so that the only way that they've seen a reduction in bag use is to put that 7 cents charge on, and not just put it on, but have the cashier ask you, "Do you want to buy a bag?"
And that
now I don't know if you're cheap like me, but when somebody says, "Do you want to buy a bag?" I'm like, "Nope, I will stick it in my shirt."
Right.
I've
walked
it
out with a handful of groceries, like I just ripped the joint off, and I'm running out to my car.
I've gone to a store and bought two bottles of wine. And for the two bottles of wine, they put them each in a small paper bag.
But you're shopping at classy joints, right?
And then they double bagged the brown grocery bag. So there were four bags for two items.
Yeah.
Now, in my defense, I usually just walk out of the store holding two bottles.
One of them already on the way down his gullet as he leaves the joint. Well, it just seems to me like, to your point, though, Heather, 7 cents, 2 cents, 20 cents, it doesn't matter. I think the very idea that you're being charged keeps people from the bag. So I think it's effective, right? It does work. And it's not the 7 cents. It's the principle. You hate to pay extra for it. So are you in the habit of bringing a reusable bag to the store?
Sure.
Of course he is.
Yeah, yeah. But not because of that tax necessarily. But yeah, like can we have a voluntary solution to this problem?
And, government. That's why government is here.
No. I know. You made the
libertarian
a wonderful face when I said what I said.
And you even saw it in some of the report. I think in the Sun-Times that was reporting on this, or the Tribune, one of the two did a really good report on this. I wish I could remember
probably
which
one. Tribune.
Probably
Tribune.
and they interviewed restaurant owners, and they said, hey, you know, what kind of packaging do you use? And they're like, you know, we stock a lot of plastic stuff. We have styrofoam, you know, like Harold's Chicken Shack, you get a styrofoam cup. But lately we've had a lot of customers saying, hey, you know, I don't need this stuff. Do you mind stocking sort of more biodegradable options? And they're happy to do that while keeping costs low for everybody else. And that seems like everybody wins. Why can't we do that?
No. It just seems to be because, well, I'm done with this subject for now. I want to go on to the Houston Astros, who in 2017 won the World Series, but they cheated throughout. What's the matter?
That was my signal. You were going to throw a breaking pitch.
The garbage can sounded just like that. It was a thump, thump. You can go back and watch a game that the White Sox played against the Astros. That's the one we've been playing on the radio. And the announcers go, he goes into the stretch, and then you hear bam, bam on the garbage lid, which means it's an off-speed pitch, and it gives the advantage to the Houston Astros hitters. They did that throughout the season. I don't know to what degree that was helpful to them in the World Series, but the Dodgers fans and columnists insist that they got cheated out of the World Series.
One thing I haven't read, has anyone read, obviously the tapes, the videotapes from the World Series games are all there. Has anyone listened to those to see if
and seen a result?
Like are there signals being, that you can, audible signals? Because, I mean, maybe
didn't we just demonstrate, Steve?
Saying, look at the, was there an impact on the World Series?
During the World Series.
But they wouldn't have made the World Series if they hadn't have done that in games like against the White Sox.
You know, given the apparent extent of this kind of cheating, that it seems to me like the smart thing to do is just to strip them of their World Series title. They did this to Memphis in the NCAA basketball championships. They took away their title because Derrick Rose was ineligible. And I don't remember if they gave the championship to the runner-up team. It's hard. You can't go back and replay the entire tournament.
They do that in Olympics. They'll call people years later and tell somebody who was in fourth, hey, guess what, you just won the bronze.
But that's because they competed individually, I think, and they were scored. Now, I don't know, would they do that to a water polo team?
I think they would.
Yeah.
Why not? But
I mean,
you kind of got hung up with me on this, Steve, because you were drilling down onto the individual players, and I think that is too difficult an exercise to find out who is exactly personally responsible.
I don't think it is. I think if you're at bat and someone's banging the can,
who's breaking the rules there?
All of them.
No. It's the person banging the can.
But the guy who's at bat
is
not
breaking the rules.
He knows about it.
The batter is the beneficiary of this.
No, he
went to bat.
No, so he had to know going up to the plate that if he heard the can,
if there was
a break. Let me finish. He had to know going to the plate if he heard the can, it was a breaking pitch. So he's
it's
part
like
of the equation.
Other,
cheating.
Yeah, like any other sign. And also they had cameras set up, I think, too. It wasn't just like, you know,
sure,
one guy.
Sure, center field
pitch, right?
Related into the dugout, and that's where the.
And we're seeing it now, right? We're seeing Alex Cora fired as the Boston manager. Carlos Beltran, is it?
Was hired
by the Mets to be the manager. Today there are reports that they are parting ways, you know, because if these players are cheaters too, it's not just the manager in general who apparently didn't endorse it but knew about it.
So then everybody in that dugout is responsible.
If they were batting and hearing the can, then I think you investigate them, you interrogate them.
Pete Rose is banned from baseball for life in the Hall of Fame, where his performance certainly makes him belong, because he bet on games. There's no proof ever that he lost a game or that an outcome of a game changed because of his betting, and yet he's banned from baseball for life, and yet this entire cheating apparatus, they find the owner, $5 billion, which is nothing.
I know, that's
to a Major League Baseball owner. It's like, I think it's in my couch cushions.
Are the pitchers then also equally responsible? Because they're not even going to go to bat. The Houston Astros pitchers.
No, I'm talking about the people who are seen at the plate.
No, you're talking about anybody who has knowledge of this is responsible for the cheat.
That's not what I said.
That's the implication, because the guy at bat, say in the dugout, they say, hey, everybody, if we ham the thing twice, that means an off-speed pitch. You didn't ask for that, and you don't even like that, but now you're going up to bat.
Okay, well,
what are you supposed to do? Strike out?
Well, maybe it's been investigated, but maybe it hasn't. I'm assuming that it hasn't been. So go to those players, and if you can prove they knew about it, if you have corroborating evidence that they knew about it, then yeah, they're guilty of cheating. If they say, I never liked it, I didn't want to do it, and you can have others, witnesses backing that up, then they're not guilty of cheating.
Rather than assigning individual blame, I think, Eric, that might be the most elegant solution, because that'd be the most preventative going forward. Because, you know, the next time it might happen, someone says, you know, I can't be implicated in this, so it's fine, I'm not going to tell anybody about it. But if you end up winning the World Series and then you get it taken away after all the hard work you did,
then you're going to speak up.
Yeah, right. Well, so let's do that. Eric, you say strip the, just unilaterally, the Astros in 2017 are no longer the World Series champ.
If they really want to crack down on this, that's what they should do.
I'm with you on that. Where are you, Steve?
Oh, I think they should absolutely do that at a minimum, and maybe take away the World Series money.
How about that? Where are you?
100% agree.
You know, the baseball has no appetite for this. What do
you
think?
Austin is for a free market solution.
which would be. I mean, it's a private
Why do we need government to decide? Why can't we just ask the individual players to turn in their rings and money? That would be awesome.
The MLB should take over the title, but don't punish. As a Cardinals fan, I cannot advocate for the punishment of Carlos Beltran. He was instrumental in there.
Now we see your World bias come out.
Yeah. So that you're a Cardinals fan?
Yeah.
Oh boy!
Well, that's the
story. Well, that changes a lot.
That was like
about
a literal womp womp.
Don't we have any other resumes, John?
Do you have a slide whistle he can play?
The loser trombone. So the impeachment is taking place as we speak. That is, that the actual trial doesn't begin until next week, but the articles have been brought over to the Senate. Heather, do you want to jump in here? What jumped out at you this week as this took place?
Well, it jumped out at me that we're still learning stuff about the alleged crime, even as this is going forward. And it's not unprecedented. The impeachment of Andrew Johnson occurred 3 days after he is alleged to have committed impeachable conduct. So they developed the reasons for the impeachment afterward. But it's, you know, the big debate is going to be on whether there are witnesses, and if there are witnesses, who are witnesses. But it's quite a sight to see Lev Parnas, who, of course, was involved in the search for dirt on Joe Biden, going on MSNBC and saying, oh, yeah, no, the president knew about it. Everybody knew about it. Giuliani knew about it. They knew exactly what I was doing. And oh, by the way, I was working with a congressional candidate from Connecticut who has mental health issues. And we had assigned goons to track the Ukrainian ambassador. Just unreal things.
You think he's credible when he talks like that?
I don't see any benefit for him to lie at this point. He's facing charges on wholly different set of charges, and he's got texts and documents and all sorts of things to back up what he's saying.
Well, they can use that. I mean, they didn't know that when they drew up the articles, but I don't know that would have changed the actual charges against the president. But the House managers can present that, right? They can use that, presumably.
Definitely. Because Nancy Pelosi delayed the delivery of the impeachment articles, that was able to be incorporated just before they sent it over.
Yeah, Parnas was saying on his interview that they stayed up like really late at night, several nights in a row, trying to get all this stuff together to get it to the House in time for the delivery of the articles.
Okay, but I hope this isn't pivotal, because I can just see America and the Senate just going, these guys are clowns. They're not reputable. They're already talking like this. I mean, I hope that the case is better than Lev Parnas.
Sure. And I think that there's a lot more evidence. But the Republicans have been saying, we don't know anybody who has firsthand knowledge. It's all hearsay. It's all secondhand. It's all thirdhand. Well, assuming that you can't force Giuliani, the president's attorney, to testify, the next best thing is a letter signed by Rudy Giuliani saying, I am acting at the behest of my client, the president of the United States, in a personal capacity. And that, I think, is certainly relevant to the charges at hand.
The witness question is going to be interesting, right? And I think if you think he was digging up dirt or rooting out corruption, whichever side you were on, it should be in your interest to have firsthand knowledge of those things and have those witnesses testify. The problem, though, is Rand Paul, either yesterday or today, came out and said, well, if you want to compel these witnesses to testify, I'd like to have some of the president's preferred witness testify, including Hunter Biden and I forget who else I say
bring it on.
Oh, the whistleblower.
I say bring it all on.
Except the whistleblower.
No, I bring on the whistleblower, but let him or her testify behind a screen. I don't think the whistleblower has anything relevant to add to this. Everything the whistleblower said has been confirmed by other witnesses on the record and by the White House notes of that phone call. But If it satisfies the Republican bloodlust for witnesses, let them have the Bidens. The Bidens come in, and if Joe Biden is the nominee, the whole Hunter Biden Burisma story is going to be big all summer. So might as well get out of the way now, put these guys under oath, have them testify to whatever they know, get that story behind them. If Biden's not the nominee, no one's going to care at all by June, right? So get that out of the way. They want Schiff to testify, they want Pelosi to testify. Let them come and testify. Say, we'll all come testify. if you'll let us test, if you'll let us call Bolton and what, who they want, Pompeo,
Mulvaney,
and Parnas for that matter. Hey, bring everybody in. Let's let some sunshine come into this process. And yeah, it could be a circus. It could really be a circus. But what else? What do the Democrats have to lose at this point? He's going to be acquitted, almost certainly. So they might as well make the most of get the whole story out there as best they can.
Well, it sets up an interesting dynamic where you now have Chief Justice John Roberts sworn in to preside over this trial, and you know his role is only a quasi judge role. He can make rulings to say no, Hunter Biden's testimony is not relevant to this issue. He could be overruled by a simple majority vote. But I think that potentially sort of puts him in the crosshairs of the president and the Republicans. And, you know, it's just one of those things is once you open it up, it's impossible to know, like, what comes next. And, you know,
Why not? I mean, so they call the Bidens. Like, is this going to waste our time? We'll all be riveted to it. Right? I mean, I don't see a problem.
Do you think that the email server cost Hillary Clinton the election? I mean, when you look back at that, how trivial that seemed compared to the stuff we deal with on a daily basis, however neglectful or irresponsible or criminal or handling of that email, her personal email server was. But that hung over, Eric, I'm thinking of what you said a moment ago, that hung over the election. And I wonder how damaging that was, because we kept wondering what was there and how awful it was.
So I had an interesting conversation with a relative whom I will not name, but he was convinced that the emails that were hacked by Russia were the emails on Hillary Clinton's server. And he would not believe me when I told him that the FBI, that the Department of Justice, that everybody agrees that the emails that were hacked by Russia belong to the Democratic National Committee and not her specific private server. So in many people's heads, those issues combined, like they just said emails. And if you weren't dedicated to sort of following accurate, reputable reporting, those two issues merged into this giant superstorm. It's like when a thunderstorm over here merges with the thunderstorm over there, and it just is like a superstorm. So I don't know that there's anything that could merge like this, although, of course, the New York Times and the Washington Post reported this week that Russia is attempting to hack Burisma, the Ukrainian gas company that Hunter Biden served on the board for. So if you love 2016...
Hey, I found, actually, a new conspiracy theory that I just saw, which I've seen people talk about, especially Bernie folks. The impeachment articles were held up to put Warren and Bernie in Washington in the weeks leading up to Iowa. What do we think?
Oh, yeah. Well, is that a conspiracy or just a matter? Oh, I see.
Helps Biden.
Yeah. Well, it is a matter of fact. I mean, that is mm-hmm. what's happening. That's for sure.
We'll see. Well, I mean, Bernie has the money, evidently, to hop on a plane when the adjournment bell rings or however there, the gavel comes down. And does Warren have the money to do that? And just hop on a plane and get to Iowa for evening events and sleep on the plane on the way home and burn the candle at both ends. It would be difficult. And you know, the campaigning in Iowa toward the run-up to the vote is basically nonstop, as I understand it. So,
well, I would argue that at this point, 10 days out from the caucus or whatever it is that we are, that it's your organization that's going to matter. That certainly the candidate can, you know, parachute in and do a certain number of events every day. But Iowa is all about organizing and caucusing and making sure that you know who your people are and helping your people get to those caucus sites. And I don't know that that the candidate, him or herself, is actually really doing any of that work.
What does Donald Trump do during all of this?
Well, he's going to give a giant rally because that's what he enjoys doing.
He does. He's very good at counter-programming, isn't he? But I mean, I wonder, does he appear before the Senate? Does he do a rally the night of the something or another? I mean, I wonder how he manages.
I'm curious what he's going to do with the State of the Union address, which is probably going to take place.
No, it will. It absolutely will.
It will now, yes. For sure. When is the date on that?
It was the, I believe it's the 5th.
February. So he's going to come into the chamber of the House that just impeached him. But didn't Clinton?
Clinton did this exact same thing. And let's not forget how Clinton greeted his impeachment. He held a giant press conference in the Rose Garden with Al Gore next to him. And Al Gore proclaimed that Bill Clinton would be remembered as one of America's greatest presidents. And I was a literal baby at the time. And even then I was thinking, well, that's going to come back to haunt you.
Like, and you were what, four?
Approximately. I was very precocious. Very precocious.
Okay. I just was struck by the pen. I was struck by the pen when Nancy Pelosi was signing the articles. She used multiple pens to sign, what, her name?
This is how legislation is always signed.
But that's legislation.
It's the exact same thing that the Republicans did with Clinton's impeachment. And in fact,
they did that,
and they had the souvenir pens, and even there was a misspelled word on the Republican ceremonial impeachment signing pen.
So
they reissued the pens. They reissued the pens. So this is...
How much
a hullabaloo about
for?
Nothing.
No. Yeah, that's what Bertrand said. I wonder what that's going for on eBay. I objected to them treating it like a souvenir event. If that was an article of war, if there was something you had to sign, I don't know what that even means, but something that we all agreed was serious, celebratory.
It seems tone deaf, doesn't it?
Doesn't it really? Especially since they're trying to paint themselves as not just being purely political and wanting to punish Trump because we don't like him. No, real crimes have been committed. This is democracy. And how about you get the pen? And you get a pen. And you get a pen.
There have been several very funny J.B. Pritzker pen signing moments.
Like what?
He has like 25 lined up when he signs a bill because he'll use a different pen for each dot, you know, of the J and the B and the dot.
It matters. On bills where you work hard on and you get that pen, you know, you get at the end, it matters to people. I thought the more cringy thing was that really weird quasi-death march of the impeachment officers with the manila folder, the leather book, exact same as
the Clinton administration, the Clinton impeachment.
We're out of time. Any last things you want to stick in here, Heather, while you've got the microphone?
I almost met Miguel Cervantes, Hamilton, from the Chicago production yesterday at the city council meeting. However, he was not as interested in taking selfies with reporters as he was with taking selfies with aldermen and mayors.
What a prima donna.
Yeah. I did get to listen to aldermen make several bad Hamilton puns.
Were they giving them
a resolution? Yeah.
What did they put into our economy? 200? 400? 400.
400 million, million or something dollars. Like that. Yeah.
Of which 200 million was profit. I mean, it was an amazing run.
Were they not selling as many tickets toward the end? Is that why they left, or did they just...
No, they left just because you want to keep the show fresh, and they're going to be eventually in Milwaukee. The touring company will be there, and they didn't want the two to be competing with each other.
There was a couple of nights, literally, there were not many, but some nights it was 90%+. Think about that. It sometimes got as low as 90%, but that was the very limited period of time last year. For the 3 years, it was virtually a sellout. 3 years and 3 months.
When are high schools going to start doing it as their spring musical?
A lot of the only discounted tickets went to sometimes students, but that was it. Right. Everybody was playing retail or secondary market. Did you see Hamilton?
Sure. I think the Latin School already has the rights. They've been doing it for two years.
Are you serious?
No. They're the only ones who can afford to do it.
All right, we're out of time. Eric Zorn, thanks for coming in. Steve Bertrand just had to exit. Austin Berg, Heather
Happy Sharon. Birthday, Mom.
Oh, is this your mom's birthday? Yeah. Happy birthday to your mom. All right. And by the way, John Williams at WGNradio.com. If we should take this show on the road, when and where, let us know, and I'll have Eric make that happen. We're produced by Olive Garrison. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.